Welcome to On Air with the Mountain Lion Foundation, broadcasting research and policy discussions to understand the issues that face the American lion.
Welcome to On Air. I'm Julie West, your host, here today with Mark Beckoff. Mark is a former professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado at Boulder and co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Mark's main areas of research include animal behavior, cognitive ethology, which is the study of animal minds, behavioral ecology, and compassionate conservation. He's won many awards for his scientific research, including the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society and a Guggenheim Fellowship. Mark has published more than 1,000 essays, 30 books, and has edited 3 encyclopedias. His books include Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation, and Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. His latest book, The Jane Effect, Celebrating Jane Goodall, and edited by Dale Peterson, was published in February 2015. You can learn more about Mark by visiting his homepage, markbeckoff.com, and that's spelled markbeckoff.com. And with Jane Goodall, the address is ethologicalethics.org, ethologicalethics.org. Welcome to On Air, Mark. Hello.
Hello. I'm glad to be here. Thank
you. Great. Now, Mark, you're also a contributing blogger for the Huffington Post, and you use that forum to reflect on a range of topics about animals and humans' relationships to animals, from the controversial killings of Cecil the lion and Blaze the bear to scientific developments regarding the emotional intelligence of animals. What prompts you to choose the stories you write about? And is there a common denominator?
Well, yeah, I guess there's a lot of common denominators. I'm really interested in what I call, you know, animal cognition, animal smarts, if you will, animal emotions, and compassionate conservation, and, you know, wrapping that into a very strong view on animal protection. So generally, the essays I write for Huffington Post, I also do regularly for Psychology Today, reflect either, you know, new empirical research in those areas or problems that we're having, like, you know, advocating killing mountain lions to save deer or killing cormorants to save salmon in Oregon. Or, you know, I wrote about Cecil, the African lion who was killed. So they're all motivated, I think, by trying to improve human-animal relationships, especially in the wild.
Yes, and you live in a beautiful wild place. You live in mountain lion country there in Boulder, and one of your recent blogs cuts close to home. You write that Colorado Parks and Wildlife has proposed a scheme to kill mountain lions in order to protect and grow mule deer populations. And you and other critics say this idea is ill-conceived and unscientific. So what rationale is being used to support this proposal, and why is it wrong?
Well, you know, once again, there's lots of sides to this issue, but it's wrong for a number of reasons. I mean, it's wrong because the empirical data show that in other studies that killing lions to save deer hasn't worked. Last year, there was this publication of a paper that included the slaughter. I mean, really, the brutal slaughter of 875 or so wolves in Canada to save rangeland caribou. And it didn't work. So basically, you know, the scientific data don't support killing one species to save another. The massive slaughter of wolves in Alberta, Canada was done supposedly to save rangeland caribou, but it didn't work. There's also really ethical questions. You know, you're going to kill lions to grow mule deer to be killed by human hunters. So, I mean, it's in my view, it's wrong on a whole lot of different levels.
It's like a chain reaction of killing. You know, you talk about this chain reaction of disruption happening in the wake of trophy hunting affecting, for example, the cubs, because new males will move in and oftentimes kill the cubs fired from the males that were killed, and female lions will often get killed protecting those cubs. So it really seems like, it's a chain reaction of death.
Exactly. That's a good way to look at it. And, you know, from an ethical point of view, we just can't go around just killing animals. And then these are really experiments, and I use that word because they're experiments. You know, they want to say, well, if killing the lions results in more deer, for example, for hunters to kill, then there are more deer out there for hunters to kill, which generates money for Colorado parks and wildlife. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Boy, I think about New Englanders who are probably wishing they had some mountain lions to deal with their deer population. It seems very ironic that Coloradans would resort to this.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I believe it's generated by a need for money. Hunting and fishing licenses, for example, generate a lot of money. And so, you know, if you don't have enough deer out there, or game as they call them, then people may not be able to buy the same number of licenses. And so what strikes me in this case is that the scientific data do not support that killing mountain lions will grow mule deer, but yet Colorado Parks and Wildlife still wants to do it. Even if there were data that supported it, it still would be ethically wrong. In other words, you can't argue, well, we know that killing the lions will produce more deer. That's just a lame argument. It becomes, if you will, lamer, and it becomes a lot more difficult to support when you can say, well, we're going to save the deer only to be killed by humans.
What do they need in order to push this through? How seriously is this proposal being taken?
Well, we don't know. I mean, there's public hearings, and as I wrote, you know, the Humane Society of the U.S. is trying to get Colorado Parks and Wildlife to have a hearing in Denver, but so far that's not been scheduled. The next one at the end of November is in Ouray, Colorado. It seems like they're very intent on it, you know. It seems like they really want this proposal to go through so they can go kill the deer. I think they're quite serious about it.
Yeah, it almost seems like any excuse to hunt the mountain lions.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, mountain lions get a really bad rap, you know. I mean, they are predators. They're a prototype predator. They do kill other animals, and on occasion, you know, they kill humans. But carnivores get a bad rap, you know, in the public eye.
Everything I've learned about predators is that they keep ecosystems in check.
Yeah, people get scared of them, though. You know, I mean, I had three up close and personal interactions with mountain lions. You know, I was really within a couple of inches of mountain lions on three occasions, and I survived, and there was nothing cool about it. When I tell people about them, they'll go, oh, that's really cool. No, there was nothing cool about them at all. I hope I never meet another mountain lion. But that doesn't mean that after my encounters when I lived in the mountains that I wanted those lions to be killed. And as I've said many times, that if I had a injurious or fatal interaction with, you know, a mountain lion or another carnivore, I wouldn't want that animal to be killed.
You mentioned it's a scheme to raise money as much as anything else, but at the end of the day, won't they be weighing the science? And from what you said in the article, the scientific research states that deer need habitat, food, and space to move and forage without heavy persecution by hunters in order to thrive. So, I would hope that some of the science would be weighed in the process of debate.
Yeah, I would too, but I know from lots of legislation in other forms, other aspects of animal protection, the use of animals in laboratories, they say, well, where's the science, where's the science, for example, that shows that mice and rats suffer, that they display empathy, that they have rich and deep emotions. The science is out there, but the people who write the legislation ignore it. So I don't have a lot of faith, and then people would dispute it. They'll say, well, the studies were done in other states, or they'll find a criticism of the study, and then they'll throw out the baby with the bathwater. But the facts are the science, the science does not support it. And there's also an ethical dimension. And when I've done other interviews and when I've talked to people about this and other cases, and this is a change that we're seeing now, currently, people are more and more concerned with ethics as well. In other words, if the science was, say, ambivalent, there are still people who would say it's wrong to kill the lions to save, to grow deer. It's not to save the deer so much. It's to, get rid of the lions and growing them basically means, having more of them. So times are really changing for the better, and divisions of wildlife are going to have to factor that in, that public sentiment is changing. And a lot of people who may have supported this, basically it's just wanton slaughter of lions, no longer will support it. That's why it's crucial to have these public hearings to get, a broad spectrum of the population and, in this case of, stakeholders in Colorado to weigh in. Yeah.
Yes, and that's where I was so heartened to see the role social media took regarding Cecil the Lion and his death, that shame is a powerful tool, and just the scarlet letter that was emblazoned on his forehead as a result of the social media messaging made me realize, interesting. This seems like it's helping to turn the tide in the way we view and treat animals.
It is. And in fact, I just wrote a blurb for a forthcoming book on mountain lions that'll be out next spring. And the author points out the same thing that, people I know, just because of this current situation that's pending in Colorado, there's people I know who were horrified to hear about Cecil and have either no opinion or think it's just fine to kill lions in Colorado.
So, right.
And that brings out, the question that comes up a lot. In fact, I just taught a course online for a class at Colorado College, and it was freshman, and one of the women in the class asked that very sort of question. Why is it that we hate, if you will, or vilify some animals and we love others? And it's, I think, the predator situation, or the fact that lions are predators, just really scares people. They're totally misunderstood. And people think that, mountain lion attacks occur every day. They don't. That's not to say that when they do occur that they can be tragic. They are. But, it's like this bear who was recently killed up in Yellowstone, Blaze, and her killing left her two cubs alive. Blaze didn't do anything, and I don't mean that in a light sort of way. Blaze didn't do anything, and it was a tragedy that a human, got killed, but it was a human who had trespassed into Blaze's territory, if you will.
Right. So what can humans do to be more accountable?
Yes, they have to be more accountable. We have to take more responsibility. And when I lived in the mountains outside of Colorado, outside of Boulder, among lions and coyotes and bobcats and black bears, I made it very clear to my neighbors, and I wasn't, once again, being facetious, that if, you know, something happened to me, don't kill the animals. We need to take responsibility. And the other thing, of course, Julie, is that there's too many humans, and we are just expanding all over the place, which means that we're going to have more and more conflicts with other animals. And that's why this study sets a horrible precedent, because, you know, people can say, well, Colorado did this, why don't we do it? You know what I mean? It's,
yes.
We need a paradigm shift. That's the way I look at it.
Let's back up for a minute, because you talk a lot about compassionate conservation. What is meant by compassionate conservation?
Well, compassionate conservation is basically the view that animals are not objects for us to exploit, and the two guiding principles for compassionate conservation are, first, do no harm, which really means that when we are interacting with other animals and trying to figure out how to peacefully coexist with them, we do not harm them. And the second is that individuals count, that we're concerned with the well-being, if you will, of individual animals, not of ecosystems or populations or species. And so applying it, you know, you could be applying it to this proposed killing of lions in Colorado. Compassionate conservation would argue against it, because the mandate is first, do no harm, and the second is individuals count, which means that every individual lion counts, and you've got the collateral damage of perhaps other lions, like cubs, dying when a female is killed.
Yes.
So this is a perfect example, although it's not necessarily a conservation issue per se. It's a perfect example where the basic tenets of compassionate conservation could be applied.
Well, in your book, Ignoring Nature No More, The Call for Compassionate Conservation, you imply that exploitation of animals continues because our relationship to the natural world itself is framed by sociocultural, political, and economic habits of exploitation. And then you write about things people can do to expand their compassion footprint.
Mm-hmm.
What are the top habits of exploitation you would like to see changed? And how can more people get on board with compassionate conservation?
Right. Well, I would like to see there be just a real general agreement that we need to peacefully coexist with other animals, you know, you could say including and especially the ones into whose homes we've moved. And I don't mean that lightly. When I moved into the mountains, I knew there were lions and other bears and other, quote, dangerous animals around. And I made that choice. So I think what we need to do is accept the fact that we need accountability and we need to take responsibility. And I think the paradigm shift would be to say, look, you know, we moved into their homes. There's too many humans. We are spreading out all over the place. And we just can't move into their homes and then decide that when they become a, quote, problem, that we're going to kill them. And
right.
And I think, you know, I already know some people who are really beginning to accept that, to say, okay, you know, if I'm going to go choose to live in the mountains or I'm going to hike somewhere where there are other animals, I need to take care and accept the fact that there are risks. And I personally have, you know, had to change my habits when there were mountain lions around. I had to change my habits in terms of when I would go out with my dogs, when I would ride up and down my dirt road, because number one, of course, I didn't want to get attacked by one of these animals, and number two, I knew they were there, and I loved knowing they were there. So the other thing I would like to see is this deeper reconnection with nature. That's what I call the rewilding, the personal rewilding, where people really reconnect, not like, oh, I'm going to go into the mountains and I'm going to spend a day there. The bottom line is, and if an animal bothers me, I'm going to report it and the animal is going to be killed. And I'm not being facetious. You know, that happens. So the personal rewilding means reconnecting with nature, appreciating nature, if you will, as it is. And the other aspect of rewilding, and I can't emphasize it too much, is accepting responsibility for what we do. If I go hike and something happens to me, then it's too bad. It's tragic. I mean, this recent bear attack and death in Yellowstone, it's a tragedy. Somebody said, oh, well, you just probably think that's okay. No, I don't. And nobody working for animals thinks that's okay. But the fact of the matter is, Blaze, in my opinion, should not have been killed, because there's also no evidence that a bear who kills him once is more likely to kill again. So it's a big paradigm shift that includes rewilding in the personal sense, and accepting the fact that these animals have the right to live the lives they've evolved to live. And if we're going to intrude into their lives, that there are attendant risks for which we need to be responsible.
Yes. I mean, the animal shouldn't be penalized for doing what's in its nature to protect the cubs. Or yes, as you say, you've just built your home adjacent to a migratory corridor. And so keep your pets in at night, or know where you are, and alter your habits accordingly. Yeah, it's a reciprocal relationship. Well, it's called being good neighbors, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, it's called being, I like that. It's called being good neighbors. It's accepting responsibility, and it's exactly what we ask of people in other aspects of life. I've often suggested to realtors around Boulder that when they show a house, they explain to the potential, buyers that there are animals such as lions and bears around, so that they know this. Because I don't know about you, but I know a number of situations where people have literally moved into an area and have moved out soon after because they didn't want to live with, they have kids, or they didn't want to live where there were dangerous animals. So rather than advocate for killing them, they moved out.
Right. Interesting. Now, you've connected with conservationists around the world and have traveled widely. Does any one country emerge as having the best overall record for compassionate conservation?
No, I think it's too early in growth, if you will, but there are phenomenal projects. One that was completed, I wrote about in an earlier Huffington Post and Psychology Today essay, in India. So India has a number of projects going that really are smack central, if you will. In terms of the tenets of compassionate conservation. The other thing about compassionate conservation is it takes into account the all stakeholders. So it takes into account the interests of the humans and the non-humans and the community. And there's a great project that that was concerned with dancing bears in India, which is a very long cultural tradition. And the way they solved it and got the people were doing it for money. It wasn't like they hated the bears. So over the years, they showed them how they have alternative modes of income, including the women who make the men. And so basically, it's put an end to the dancing bears. And that's it. That's just a perfect example of the scope of compassionate conservation, taking into account the interests of the non-humans, the humans, and the community. And there's a number, there's another project where there are tigers who kill humans, And they realized that instead of talking about the problem animals, they started talking about problem locations and got people to avoid the locations at certain times. And so it was just the flip in the vernacular, if you will, talking that this is a problem location rather than this is a problem animal. And we're very, you know, humans are very sensitive to the use of words. And just the people who did this study, you know, agreed that just changing from problem animal to problem location helped to solve the problem.
Yes, that's so true. And again, it comes back to accountability, because knowing I live in a high problem area, whether it's India or the mountains of Colorado, yeah, what can I do to adapt my patterns accordingly? So like in India, maybe don't throw trash outside your home, which will attract the stray dogs, which will attract the leopards and tigers, or don't collect wood in the forest. You know, all basic things people can do to modify their habits. And also, it's interesting you mentioned India, because I feel like the Vedas themselves, those ancient, that ancient body of knowledge, itself has carried many messages of compassionate conservation through the teaching.
No, absolutely.
Well, you co-edited the book Listening to Cougar with Tara Blessley Lowe, and the foreword written by Jane Goodall. And this is a collection of essays about cougar ecology and people's encounters with the big cats. And you shared some of your encounters. Did you learn anything new about the mountain lion through some of these stories?
I learned how much people are so interested in mountain lions, not only from, you know, the scientific point of view, but the role that they play in, you know, just in mythology, in Native American literature, in the arts. So yeah, I learned a lot. You know, what doing that book, and you know, I still see essays written by poets and writers, people who are naturalists, scientists, artists, is just the magnificence of the mountain lion, the cougar. And so, you know, I'm hoping also that widespread interest will help protect these animals.
Yes, because there is such intrigue. And I think it's a shame that in our news, what makes front page are these, you know, tragic stories. You know, wouldn't it be interesting if our journalists and our papers were full of these inspiring stories about how we can actually reach out across our biological boundaries and understand each other? You know,
yeah.
It would be wonderful if that were freed from, you know, the scientific journals and actually became more, you know, part of popular culture.
Absolutely. And that's why I was saying that, you know, getting the interest of, you know, getting people interested in animals such as, you know, cougars, mountain lions, grizzlies, elephants, you know, any animal, getting them interested, you know, in, if you will, the lay population, non-researchers, artists, people in the humanities, writers, is really the way forward to even grant, you know, to grant more protection and get more respect for these animals. Yeah.
Yes. Now, you've partnered with Jane Goodall to create Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Has this effort made traction in field research and animal laboratories? And maybe you could give some examples if you know it's made a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's made a difference in terms of field research, if you will, trapping and marking methods, making sure that, you know, they're humane. And the big thing is that they don't change the data. We know that when you start handling wild animals, you can affect their behavior and you can change their behavior, which affects the reliability of the data you collect. So, yeah, I mean, people, I get lots of emails of people saying, you know, I'd like to mark animals this way, you know, and really, in many ways, it's sort of preface of compassionate conservation. It kind of prefaced, if you will, compassionate conservation. I mean, Jane and I mean, both together and separately, have been writing about the importance of individual animals for years. And so when I looked at the description of ethologists for the ethical treatment of animals, which was put forth about 14 or 15 years ago, it really parallels a lot of what compassionate conservation is all about, and that is using humane methods, first do no harm, and the importance of individual animals.
Well, in thinking on cognitive ethology, are there any latest developments you wish to highlight, or any new information about what we're learning about the way animals feel and think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it seems like every day I'm getting something new about animal cognition and animal emotions. And, you know, so a lot of what we're getting is, you know, people who are studying food animals, that cows are very emotional, pigs are empathic. We've got some really great data coming in on birds, predicting the future existence of certain foods, planning their meals for the future. And there's a lot of stuff coming in on fish, showing how, in fact, they are very emotional beings, and that, you know, let's put it this way. The data that are coming in do not counter what we have, quote, thought about these animals. You know what I mean? The scientific data really support. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think the challenge is you have this information, but then how can you reach across the aisle and convince the big cat trophy hunter to care? If you had 3 minutes to chat with a big cat trophy hunter, you know, what would you say? What would you say to change that person's
mind? I would just explain to them, you know, that they're killing animals who have deep emotional lives, that they're killing animals who have families. So if they kill one animal, they kill another animal. And I would also just try to have a rational discussion with them of why just killing animals as trophies is just wrong. My take on it, and I'd rather talk to people who are not, you know, when I'm not preaching to the converted, but my take on it, in all honesty, is we just need to keep putting this information out there and hope people grab onto it. I mean, people don't, you know. So I've talked to some people who have given up hunting, not immediately, but based on sentience, based on the taking of, you know, taking a life of an emotional being, taking the life of an animal who, you know, when there might be collateral damage. But I think we just need to keep putting it out there. That's what we need to do. Unwaveringly. Don't say, oh, okay, that's okay if you only kill two lions or if you only kill two bears. No, it's not okay. Killing mountain lions does not save mule deer. Killing mountain lions, killing grizzlies, killing wolves, killing other animals is wrong, you know, for hanging them up on your wall or getting rid of them because they're pests. I try to talk to them about what we really know about the behavior of these animals, that, you know, that there are very, you know, some people just say, oh, well, you know, somebody was saying to me, oh, wolves just attack humans every day. Well, no, they don't. There's only been two known attacks, you know, in North America. So I just put it out there. I'm nice to them. I invite them to talk as long as they respect me and I will respect them and move on.
So Mark, how can people get involved, fellow Coloradoans who might be listening? Is there a way they can lend their voice before it goes to vote?
Well, I have a link on my article, and they'll see where the next hearing is. They can write letters directly to Colorado Parks and Wildlife. The address, you know, they can email them or call them or write letters. There's all that information is on the website for the Colorado Parks and Wildlife. They could try to go to the hearing in Ouray. They could request, as is the Humane Society of the U.S., having a hearing in Denver. You know. And put a lot of pressure on them. That's all they can do. Yeah, that's
what
I think.
I see our time is about up, Mark. Is there anything else you would like to, a closing thought you would like to share with us? Or perhaps one of your own encounters with a mountain lion?
Well, I mean, I appreciate your talking with me. As a closing thought, is we can all do better in our interactions with other animals. And like I said before, we have to respect them for who they are, not what they are, but for who they are, and take responsibility for our behavior. One of my encounters involved, I was yelling at a neighbor that there was a lion in the neighborhood and backing up, and my neighbor was kind of pointing frantically, so I would look behind me. And I looked behind me just as I literally almost stepped into a mountain lion. I was a couple of inches away. So, of course, the first thing I did was I ran, because that's what you do. I know you're not supposed to run, but I ran as fast as I could, you know, up the hillside, and the lion just sat there. And it turned out he had killed a deer. He had eaten about 25 pounds of food. His stomach was almost hitting the ground. And
lucky you.
And
he was already full.
Right. I was lucky. It's interesting to tell that story, but there's nothing funny about it. I mean, I literally was a couple of inches away from that lion. And so my take was, you know, somebody had called it in. We were very firm with whoever came up. I don't remember which agency came up, that they could not kill the lion. And they did not. And they took the carcass away. The lion slept for 2 days on a rock and then disappeared. And so having had three encounters like that, I feel that I can say that, you know, with just a lot of great, you know, veracity and enthusiasm, I loved meeting the lion. I never want to meet him again in that situation. I loved afterwards, you know, I lived up where I had that encounter. I lived, you know, for another 25 years almost. I was very happy that there are lions around, and I changed the behavior of myself and my dog.
Yes. Well, that sounds like a happy ending to me. I mean, sometimes I think more than as much as we have a curiosity for seeing them, we give greater respect by just giving them their space and taking comfort in the knowledge that they're out there in the wild doing their thing, hidden from man.
Yep. Yep, that's exactly right. And, you know, like I said, it's a mix of science and ethics and, in my view, what's right and wrong. And it's definitely wrong to kill animals just to kill them.
Well, Mark, thank you for your time today. And I encourage our listeners to read more about your ideas by visiting the Huffington Post and also Psychology Today. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much, Julie. My pleasure.
This has been a Mountain Lion Foundation On Air broadcast. On Air is a copyrighted production of the Mountain Lion Foundation. Permission to rebroadcast is granted for non-commercial use. For more information, visit mountainlion.org.